Hi, welcome to episode 7 of Inside Learning Technology for the 6th of March 2013. From fixed to flexible. It's been some time since we did this. I was just checking. This is episode 7 tonight of our Inside Learning Tech specials. Episode 6, would you believe, was as far back as late September.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That is hard to believe.
Yeah. I think we put it out on the Thursday, but we actually recorded it on September the 26th. So it is hard to believe. Yeah, we've been trying for some time. It's really been me that's pushing this idea that, you know, Inside Learning as a podcast is you know, in a small community of, you know, British educators, it's pretty well established. You know, we're kicking on that 3,000 downloads a month now. Still growing. I couldn't believe, actually. I thought we weren't going to grow in February, you know, because it's 28 days long. But we actually had a bit of growth there as well. We were a few gigabytes beyond the previous month again, so we seem to be getting really steady growth. But I just feel as if that there's scope for people who are in the tech community who tend to lead, you know, things like, you know, the Twitter debates and stuff like that. I know it's not exclusively the case in the way it used to be, but it tends to be people that are drawn to that kind of thinking in education that drive debate online. So I've always felt that there was scope for us to develop this in parallel and to have a really strong tech community contributing to and listening to a tech podcast. But the difficulty, as ever with these things, is finding people that want to commit to doing a podcast, because, you know, it's easy to go on Twitter for half an hour when you feel like it, but, you know, podcast requires that, you know, hour and a half, you know, weekly to sort of, you know, edit and record. So far you've been the emerging person, Laurie, as the committed help for this. So we'll get episode 7 in the can tonight and we'll see where we go with it.
Yeah, well, we've had a conversation about kind of having a kind of core team, and I'd be very interested in helping you take this forward. I think it's a really great idea and real potential. I think there's an interest in learning technology, crucial part in how teachers are evolving their practice, and makes a lot of sense to have a kind of specialist track.
I think so. And most other podcasts, you know, that I started listening to, you know, 5 or 6 or more years ago when I got keen in podcasting, they were tech podcasts.
Yes, so that's right.
That community's always been kind of a leader in this. So, yeah. I'm sure that there is an audience for it and a community, yeah, more importantly. Anyway, look, why don't we kick off tonight just by reminding people who we are, because there may be some new listeners to this cast over and above the usual ones. So for people that don't know me, I'm Matthew Boyle. I'm a quality improvement officer for Argyll and Bute Council in my work time. Always been involved in education, though, in various ways. A teacher in the background and researcher briefly, and also freelance, you know, a tutor of learning skills and a little bit of, you know, developmental work for schools in the past. So there we go. That's who I am. People might be interested in a wee bit about your background, Laurie.
Background is in school teaching, secondary school teaching, mainly, in fact, exclusively in the east of Scotland, from Edinburgh to rural Perthshire. Worked for Dundee City Council as an ICT advisor in a similar role to the one you've got at the moment with Argyll and Bute, Matthew.
Oh, I should have mentioned, that's right. I'm actually the ICT coordinator for schools as well.
Yeah, I was at a kind of QIO ICT advisor role. And then moved to Learning and Teaching in Scotland in 2001. The great job title of Head of Future Learning and Teaching.
That's fantastic.
Best job title I think I'll ever have. And that was a great role, looking, well, very much the kind of early days of the new curriculum, starting to think about what's next?
Actually, when you guested with Steve and I again on Inside Learning a few weeks ago, that inspired us to do a bit of creative thinking in the next episode, just talking about your job title after the cast.
Yeah.
It was quite good fun. We took the achievement gap, which is obviously very newsworthy at the moment, and tried to think of some kind of different approaches to solving that. But anyway, carry on, I ruined your flow there.
No, not at all. And ended up after kind of 8 years at LTS in the role of as Director of Learning and Technology, and led the National Grid for Learning, all national emerging technology stuff, so around Derek Robertson's work on the Consilarium, recruited a few others into that space, and of course the GLO National Schools Intranet was within my remit. The last 4 years I've been a self-employed consultant, advisor and visiting professor, and had a lot of fun working with big companies, small companies, startup companies, established companies, public sector, voluntary sector, and mainly focused around improving learning. Right. So that's my big interest.
So
where learning, technology and innovation come together would be my sweet spot.
Right. So when you say learning in companies, do you mean the learning of the workers or the team in the companies, or do you mean companies that provide learning for education?
There's been a bit of both. It's largely been companies who want to supply products and services into education.
Mm-hmm.
And more often than not, they start off with a technology. And their view is, how might we sell this technology into education?
Yeah.
And my role has been to say, actually, you need to spend a bit of time thinking about how people learn. How do teachers teach? What's the nature of the learner, the nature of the teacher, and the context that they find themselves in?
Yeah.
How might you design your products and services in such a way that you can add some value to the processes of learning and teaching?
Yeah, that's music to my ears, because in my role, as you can imagine, I often get companies cold calling me and offering some tech solution, very often around networking or something like that, that's entirely around, clearly a product that they've got for corporate or enterprise sales, and just thinking, let's try our arm in the education side. It's just all about computing, isn't it? And you're right that, the fit and the ability to sell is very, very, is often very weak.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what you've got is typically companies have designed something for the corporate space, but they look at education as a huge market. It's a multi-billion-dollar market and growing at a time where many other sectors of the economy are shrinking post the 2008 banking crisis.
Yeah.
And so education's seen as an easy target. They've got no idea or really any interest in schools and universities and learners and teachers, and certainly not in learning. And so they often start with the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah.
They're pushing a technology rather than working at how they might help meet teachers and learners achieve their aspirations and meet some of the outstanding needs that we clearly have.
Well, I guess that's as good a launching off point as any for us to do a bit of chatting around the tech situation tonight, because what listeners want to hear is some intelligent debate and some real insight into what's happening. But since we couldn't find anyone to fit the bill, what they can settle for instead is two guys bumping their gums with too much ego. Could we fulfil that need?
I think we'll do our very best.
So to conclude what we've said so far, I guess anyone listening to the cast from tonight interested in use of ICT and learning technologies in schools, we'd love to have you involved, guesting, even helping to be part of a circle of regular friends and hosts even of the podcast. So get in touch with us and let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's build a little community of people who have got something to say, which is relevant, interesting, isn't about promoting their own ego, but it's about trying to shine a little bit of light on some of the major challenges we face in the world of learning and education.
Absolutely. Well, we talked a little bit about what the big stories are in Scottish education just now, and we thought we'd come to talking about the report of the ICT Excellence Group. We had Charlie Love, of course, on this podcast quite some time ago, but we also had him on the Inside Learning podcast recently talking about some of his work around Glue, but also, you know, his part in the Excellence Group. But we might want to just pick up first on a couple of the news items that are out there just now. Will we do that first?
Yeah.
We talked beforehand. Let's go for the first one. We talked beforehand about an interesting one which throws up lots of linked questions. Yahoo, last week, was it? Had a leak. Was it leaked? I don't think it was publicised, was it? Marissa Mayer, their new chief officer, is she CEO, former Google executive. She's thrown a bit of a strop and sent out a letter to all employees saying basically the happy days of you working at home are kind of over, but it's worded as, you know, we work best as a team when we're together as a team. So basically, you know, Yahoo as the flexible tech company is now being portrayed as a slightly more old fashioned reactionary get yourself in the offices and clock in and clock out business. Did you have any thoughts on that? Is this a good way forward, and does it teach us anything for education?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? It's about presenteeism and the kind of idea that what's important are inputs. So if I were in her position, I'd be very much interested in the outputs and the outcomes.
Yeah.
So turning up at work and spending lots of time in a traffic jam or you know, bumping into, you know, your colleagues in the, while they're making a cup of coffee, can be really that can be useful, but to do that every day, I'm not convinced. So I think there's a question of trust, and it's a question of focusing on the wrong things.
Absolutely.
Very old fashioned model. The amount of time that's lost and the productivity that's lost and the costs inherent in having someone working in a air conditioned office, usually costing a huge amount of rent in the centre of a city. I think that model's dying.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is as well. I know that lots of councils, my own one included, are doing all kinds of studies about, you know, who would be willing to work from home and what, you know, what infrastructure needs to be put in place to support that. Because central buildings are expensive to maintain, you know, and I guess that there is a trend, isn't there, in leadership theory as well now to, as you say, measure outputs. Don't measure time spent at a desk, but it's what are the, you know, the three projects you're working on? When are your deadlines for them? What's the product you're going to produce? And, you know, will it be of quality? And that should be what matters. And there seems to be some evidence that people are able to do that very effectively if they're given peace and a bit of self-management around that, and the home environment can often produce that. So I don't want to get into what Marissa Mayer was thinking there, because you know, who knows what the internal politics are at Yahoo. But in terms of schools, you know, it's interesting because it holds a mirror up, doesn't it, to schools, you know, because actually that kind of creative working is what we would like learners to do as well. I imagine, I know I would like to be able to set learners deadlines and say, you know, this unit of work, you know, this is your rubric, your suggested set of online materials. You could be flexible, you know, do it in your own way, but, you know, off you go for some proportion of your week and do some self-directed learning. But
yeah,
culturally we're not even at the races in that one, are we? We're not there.
Yeah, quite interesting. When I was a 6-year student, when you had a free period, you could leave the school, you'd go home. So
right.
If you had a free period before lunch, you could leave. And nowadays, 6-year students tend to be on site 9 till 3:30, the same as 1st-year students.
Yes.
I remember that I was a principal teacher of computing in a school in Dundee, and I was also head of 6-year, and the head teacher abolished free periods and any flexibility for students to go and work off site, and his argument was that they just messed around, they went and played games or played football, they didn't do any study.
Mm.
And my argument with him was that he wasn't preparing them for the next stage in their life. So they were going to perhaps get slightly better qualifications, although that was arguable. He couldn't provide any evidence for that. But certainly what he was doing was he was not giving them the chance to have any control over their time or any autonomy. And so as soon as they went to university, then they would struggle because suddenly there was no one making sure they were at all their lectures, all their seminars. They hadn't got that kind of self-management ability. So there's always a balance to be struck. And I think if the focus is on outcomes, then what you would do is if an employee or a senior student, clearly you don't want five-year-olds to be able to walk off site and do their own thing. So there's a progressive release of control over time based on health and safety and all those things. But you would want to say, so we've given you some time that's more flexible. We expect you to achieve these outcomes, hand in this amount of coursework in that time. If you don't do it, then perhaps you lose the privilege. So
yeah,
there should be some consequences for not being able to manage, and maybe perhaps also some training.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Actually getting them to talk to people who do self-manage their work well and training on how to diary that time, how to make effective lists.
Yeah,
absolutely. How to focus for the correct period of time when it's a task that you're not in flow with, and how to chunk it down. I could see that. Of course, there is another in between, which is that, this idea of having them go off-site doesn't have to be off-site. You know, you could create spaces within a modern school or a future school, couldn't you, that were actually, I believe the trendy term in the 90s and the early noughties was, learning pods, wasn't it? You know, the idea that you could have these personal spaces and you could just timetable in some space, and just say, it's the Google idea, isn't it? That we'll direct a big chunk of your week, but, there's no reason why you couldn't have 20% of it to yourself for the agreed targets that you're going to work on. And, it's really just the idea about cutting out that part of the curriculum for excellence in Scotland that says that we value personalisation and choice. And part of that, I think, by implication is personalisation of approach, but I don't think we're there. But what is interesting is there's no counsel of pessimism on this, because whether it's a good way to go or not, and I think we're both saying that we think it's worth exploring and managing it, but whether we think it or not at this point as a profession, I just think technology is going to push us in this direction. We're not going to be able to avoid the genie that's whizzing out the bottle at this very moment. Youngsters doing more learning in their own time anyway.
Massively more flexible approach. But the interesting thing, Matthew, in education is why do we not know what works there? Why have we not collected the evidence to say you do better if your time is more flexible? Why do we not know that?
Well, I'm going to credit Glasgow Tweacher, who you will know from the Twitter learning community, with the answer for that. But a week ago, she wrote this very profound statement when she said, effectively, I'm paraphrasing here, please, I'm not quoting what she said, but it was effectively, how come our profession is so non-evidence-based? The policy, I think, was what she was talking about. It seems to be non-evidence based. I think there's your answer. We have no culture of collecting evidence for anything. Certainly not for future thinking on a large scale. And where we have small scale evidence, we have a culture of working around it and trying to figure out why it's not valid or relevant. We're not a research based community.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is interesting, Laurie. Forgive me. Very interesting because, as I recall, the definitions that they use in postgrad courses for a profession are all about the fact that you've got a body of learning and a research community underpinning your work. But actually, it's not enough that you just have researchers somewhere, but you have to have it underpinning your work. And I'm not convinced we're good at that yet.
Yeah, I don't know if you've come across John Hattie's work, Visible Learning.
Sure,
fantastic piece of work. And what he does is, to some extent, he would refute that argument you've made. Hattie argues that, in fact, there are, for example, reading strategies. Patty would say there are tens of thousands of research studies with massive samples that, and there's a result of that. There are some breeding strategies we know work and others that don't work as well. And some blends of those strategies which are more effective than using single strategies on their own. But what we've got as professionals, we don't instill that interest in what knowledge do we have. Teachers don't routinely study research because it's often presented in a way which appears to be contradictory. It seems to point both ways. So is it right to set a class or stream a class? And you find research studies that point both ways in that.
Exactly.
Is class size important in terms of student achievement? The research is up to a point. But it's not as conclusive as if you take this drug, it will have this effect on a particular condition. So it's a different kind of evidence we collect. But as Aristotle said, you know, seek exactness in everything as far as the fields you're studying allows. So there is an exactness in education, but we certainly don't take advantage of the research that's already out there.
Yeah, I agree. So that's a whole different area that I'd love to get into there. I'm not sure whether we'd even want to go there, but you know, your first example, I believe, was the area of educational research that there is most of. You know, how to teach reading, you know, phonics, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That has the largest research base out of any areas. So in a sense, I guess what you could say is that it's also quite a safe thing for teachers to engage with, because actually it doesn't threaten your practice to try a different version of phonics.
Yeah,
not fundamentally and deeply, but if you do research on something like how different learning spaces would affect, or learning timetabling would affect learning, then it fundamentally does challenge and affect the current factory employment model. So, so there should be something in these scales about degree of challenge to teachers.
Yeah, that's right. Degree of challenge to the existing model.
That's so exactly.
How far is it just a tweak to an established model, and to what extent does it completely overturn the established model and suggest there's a better way of doing things?
Yeah, and I guess the acid test of whether we are, because I'm going to have to go and reflect on this in case I've been harsh, but the acid test of whether we're a reflective research-based profession would be that we also take on board the research where it tells us things demonstrably that we don't then take on board. For example, that secondary schools, according to, for example, the Sutton Trust's very large scale research, which I think was probably English based, that they don't turn around performance in children that are, you know, predicted underachievers when they come into the start of secondary. Mm-hmm. There was that shocking figure that was something like 4,000 schools that they found zero children who had made the 5 A to C. I think it must be GCSE by the end of the fourth secondary year target, you know, who had been predicted as not in that category. I can't remember the precise categorization, but when they left primary. So, you know, you can cavil however you like around that kind of thing, but it tells you something about a certain, you know, monolithic conservatism around, you know, with a small C around the, you know, the school system.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, we talked about a couple of other news things. You had something that was exercising just now. Can I throw in a very tiny one that I don't think needs discussion? Yeah. Did you notice the interesting story about the EU throwing some money into to underpin development of technology teaching, you know, computing and coding, because they've identified predicted massive job shortages in that area?
No, I didn't pick that one up at all.
I'm
that's
just trying to find it as we speak, actually. It follows on from things like, remember the NextGen report, which identified, yeah. I mean, Charlie Love mentioned this on the Inside Learning podcast last week, there's something like, 30 or 40,000 jobs, they reckon, over the next decade. And I don't know whether that was, I think that was Scotland, wasn't it? And the employers are already predicting that they're going to have to recruit from abroad or outsource the work, you know. So
yeah, absolutely.
So this was just the European version of that, just saying. It wasn't big money, though. It looked like a, I can't recall, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't hundreds of millions or anything like that. It was a few million being put into pushing
probably
that.
Probably enough to raise the profile of it.
I think that was it, yeah. And that's the story, is that they're beginning to talk at European level about this as a response to the changing, you know, economic patterns of the world.
Yeah. What you've got in Scotland, and I think to some extent the same elsewhere in the UK, two things happened. One was there was a massive investment in technology in schools, the National Grid for Learning, New Opportunities Fund, and the like, which tended to promote technology for teaching and learning in general. But at the same time, there was a lack of investment in computer science.
Yeah.
And in Scotland, the computer science qualifications are absolutely dreadful. Now, the people who designed standard grade computing studies and higher and advanced higher computer studies really should hang their heads in shame, because what they did is they put a whole generation or more off studying computing. They made them as dull and as boring and as time stamped as they possibly could.
You don't think it's time that you just came out and shared your true feelings in this one, though? You know,
Remember, I was once a computer studies teacher.
Yeah, so you feel you can comment with some authority on this.
Like, standard grade computing studies, it's pretty much the same as it was in the mid 1980s.
Right.
Higher computing is a disgraceful qualification, as is. Information studies in Scotland. These are absolutely dreadful. Designed by a committee who didn't have a clue, and supported by a qualifications authority which really has innovated massively in computing qualifications for colleges, but the school-based qualifications are a disgrace.
Do you know that's a comment that Joe Wilson made? He was our last guest on Inside Learning last week. And he said the very same thing, that they have a huge variety of qualifications and approaches, including use of technology, you know, online randomised testing, that kind of thing, which FE colleges are making significant use of, but schools are still sticking very much with the traditional models.
Yeah. Well, probably for another discussion.
For another cast,
make a cast in itself.
So we should get Joe on to talk to us about that on this cast, actually. That would be good.
That'd be really good. Be good to bring Joe on. Joe's got a lot to say in the area. He's a bit more supportive of the SQA being an employee than I am.
He would be.
As somebody thinks it should probably be abolished and we should focus on learning rather than qualifications.
Sure.
But there's certainly a good argument had there. How would you design... Maybe my last point in this, and I think I've said it before, is that I think that computer science should have been the fourth science. So that it should be given the status, the digital science should be given the same status as the physical science, chemical science, and the life science.
I don't think that's too strong a statement, actually, when you see the way the world's going. Also, it's quite shameful that in the vast folder that our own beloved friend of the cast, David Cameron, always talks about, you know, the vast folder of outcomes in the new Scottish curriculum. Mm-hmm. There's very little in it on ICT.
Yeah, that's right.
It's quite absolutely shocking. We've got all sorts of cross-cutting work in there that's pretty fully outcomed, but there's less explicitly on ICT than I won't single out any particular areas, but than I could name.
There's an assumption that ICT is going to be used, woven into teaching and learning, but the study of it in itself and for itself is pretty much within the technology outcomes, but they're pretty weak and to me look a bit dated. There's the odd mention of designing computer games, but that seems to me to be a very much an afterthought and a bit of a sop to
the way I feel
some thinking.
The way I feel about it over the last couple of decades and, you know, the summary of it in the curricular documents now is that basically a lot of people assumed that something around about the level of the European computer driving license was what our average person needed to drive the next generation of tech users. And actually what they've got is tech users.
Yeah, so, and that's important. Having a certain level of competence and being able to use these tools, spreadsheets, word processors, databases, graphics packages, that's important. I think we need to get everyone up to a certain level.
Yeah.
But for me, the computer science, we need people who understand physics in some depth, who understand chemistry in some depth, who understand biology in some depth. I think computer science should be seen as important in that sense. So there's a general need to be able to use applications, but there are some people who should be exposed to advanced study.
Yeah.
And in order to get those people, you need to expose everyone to that domain as early as possible and show it as a significant area of human knowledge and skill that needs to be developed, explored, and studied in depth.
Excellent. Well, that was my "this doesn't need discussion" short topic. So, did you spot anything else? I'm shutting up on the news.
On news, I suppose kind of a couple of bits of news that jumping out to me. One, I'm really fascinated by the decline of Apple in terms of its share price.
That's very interesting because its profitability, I believe, has actually gone up.
Its profit's gone up. Something like 70% of its products have been invented and sold, and you know, within the last 6 months. So this share price thing is to do with the expectations of Wall Street, and the expectation is that Apple's share price would, or Apple's profits and market share would continue to grow exponentially. And it seems to be another example of a gap between reality and theory. So there's a lack of understanding. You can't continue to have exponential growth. There's only so many people on the planet.
Yeah, absolutely.
So many people can buy these devices. So it's very, very strange. And I'd love to someone out there listening today who can explain why companies reach a certain share price based on analysts' expectations of growth, and how those expectations are impossible to achieve.
Yeah, I suppose the parallel is Microsoft, who for a long while, I don't know quite where they are right this minute, but for a long while they were a hugely profitable company, and their share price was very flat, because people didn't invest in Microsoft to make money, because it was just a stable blue chip share. Whereas, you know, Apple was growing. Is it as simple as that? It's a market gauge of expectations of future growth, and therefore, you know, turn in your profit.
There's something in the maths of future growth which doesn't add up to me.
Certainly,
for another podcast. We can look at some of the science of future growth and how companies reach a certain point, and is the mathematical term asymptotic, where they get so far and then it's flat.
I don't know anything about
flat,
that.
Flat, but it's a massive. They're still massively profitable.
Yeah.
But the growth is flat.
Yes. In terms of the market though, they're basically saying they don't expect another immediate spike in growth.
Yeah.
But interesting.
That's because of competition, because of,
as you say, saturated markets. Yeah.
So you can't keep increasing the price of your products, because there's only so much the market will take in terms of a difference in price. So,
yeah, I mean, you're right, we shouldn't go too much into it, but a couple of interesting observations do leak to mind. One is that in innovation, Apple have not been as innovative in the last few years as they were. Obviously, people then start to question whether whether not having the top man makes a difference now that Jobs is gone. Yeah. There's also an interesting observation about schools. Schools, by and large, in Scotland and I believe the UK, have moved away quite dramatically from Apple computers because of cost. But there's an interesting phenomenon just now whereby Apple are putting iPads into schools suddenly in exploding numbers. So, we could start to see Apple be a bigger player in schools again than they were becoming.
Yeah. Certainly, education was a big part of Apple's early DNA. It was educators who would be the, the most likely users of Apple computers, and it moves into the graphics and design area. So interesting to see if the iPad really brings Apple back to having a strong presence in schools again.
Anyway, I've got just the idea for Tim Cook anyway. If he wants to revive the fortunes there, the product that would make me tempted is... I don't particularly have my eyes on any Apple product at the moment. I use an iMac as my kind of photo processing machine. I do a bit of photography, and I like the big screen, and I can lift it out of the way on and off a table form factor. That works well for me. But I think that with the explosion of tablet use just now, and they've been moving their own operating system, haven't they, towards having more of the tabletized interface, the kind of iOS type icon interface within... within macOS, I think that the market's ready for them to build something like that lovely, sexy, slender wee MacBook Air. Is that the one that basically flips around in itself and becomes a tablet?
Yeah,
I think if they nail that, they'll have a whole new market of people that want the power of occasional 11-inch computing. That can actually run Photoshop and stuff like that for them, but also swivel it around and it's a full touch tablet. I think that would be a winner for them.
Yeah. I think that's quite, is that not called a Microsoft Surface?
Do you know, I was thinking it as I said it. You picked that inadvertent link up. Yeah, I guess it is, isn't it? Yeah. Except it would be a Surface that had, 700 or 800,000 apps that worked when you went to the Surface side of it,
Okay.
I think the Microsoft ones only, they're not just proudly say recently, they crossed 25,000 apps for the Windows RT, the Metro style interface, in other words, the touch interface.
Yeah, touch interface. I think what you'll expect is a number of, take a bit of time to catch up. It's going to be interesting to see how competition in that space works out, because you've got the Kindle Fire, you've got the Android, range of Android devices, Microsoft and Apple, and just seeing which of those is going to be the most successful at the moment. Apple's ecosystem is the strongest, and that includes the apps, but also includes the integration with the iTunes, the music side of things, and that's a very, very strong offering, but huge competition.
Well,
there, and you expect a lot of innovation in that space.
Pretty sure this year that Android tablets took over in sales numbers, but you're right, the ecosystem and the app system, it's definitely there for Apple. They've still got the monopoly. I don't see them innovating terribly much, though. There is scope for other companies like Samsung, in particular, to undercut them and do something. At the moment, I'm not seeing it, though. They're doing a lot of products that are, interesting. Like, for example, the Galaxy Notes, with their stylus and their integrated digitizers, those sort of things. There's a lot of good stuff there, but the cost is still high. So, consumers are going to go for the Apple product until they've got a tablet that undercuts and is of, serious quality and, has got good features. I don't think apps are such a big problem now for Android. They've got a pretty good app base now. But in education, not so much. If you want to buy some of those really specialist education apps, you're right, that, DNA of Apple where, school writers tend to focus their development on Apple, I think they've got a significant advantage there.
Yeah. I think one of the challenges to the app world will be the move to the cloud. So it won't matter. Yeah, at the moment we've got a kind of hybrid model where you have apps which are kind of on the device, and you've got cloud-based services. Now, the wonderful thing about if you're moving to the cloud, if you've got a standards-based browser, then it should work on any device. It shouldn't matter if it's a Kindle, Apple, Android. So that would be, for me, that would be the big challenge. Because then you're talking about, well, does it really matter which of these devices? So you then make a choice based on which is the one you like the feel of, and is at the right price point. But the services are all out there. They're all cloud-based. They're OS independent.
It's one of the reasons, if you're going to be critical of Apple, and I often am, it's one of the reasons why they try and keep away from standards-based. Because they don't want that, do they? They want us to keep needing their ecosystem. And I guess what I'm saying here is buyer beware, because in education, we are now buying into, you know, the likes of the iPads, right, you know, in colossal numbers. And although it's slick and it's working well for us at the moment, or it will be when we iron out some of the teething troubles, that's one for an episode soon. The trouble is that you're then totally trapped in that ecosystem. You know, it won't play nice with lots of other peripherals, and as we get genuine, you know, low price Android tablets or whatever else comes that's standards compliant, and you know, we're into more HTML5 apps, that kind of thing. We will possibly be stuck with, you know, schools full of Apple TVs and Apple, what do you call it, AirPlay devices, nothing else allowed. And I don't see them suddenly pulling the cost down at that time.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, Matthew. The standards approach is really important, and one of the challenges is jumping from the frying pan into the fire. So the Microsoft world is also not standards based, and jumping from the Microsoft world to the Apple world is potentially a bit of a disaster for education. And that's why, for me, the standards have got to be around the browser, not the operating system.
Yeah, definitely.
That's the way forward. Now, of course, there are challenges and technology challenges and usability challenges moving to the cloud in a way that the app world manages that very, very cleverly. But I think that's another big debate for the future.
Well, it's good.
Standards for education.
Yeah, well, we've set up a nice wee set of debates here. Anything else caught your eye in the news? You mentioned something about MOOCs.
Yeah, I'm in one of my roles. I'm a visiting professor of learning, innovation, and technology at the University of Aberdeen in Dundee.
That's a particularly windswept title.
It's a great title. I love it. It's almost as good as Head of Future Learning and Teaching, but not quite. And do a little bit of work around quality enhancement, and I'm looking at technology enhanced learning at the moment, and been doing a little bit of reading and writing around massively open online courses, which are beginning to sweep higher education globally. Very, very interesting, looking at the elite universities clubbing together in a not very open way, in a very closed way. Mm-hmm. To provide a range of free online courses that can be taken by anyone, anywhere in the world. So, for example, Edinburgh University has 6 courses on offer at the moment. They're one of the 62 Coursera partners. Their courses range from Introduction to Philosophy to Equine Nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very slick, very well produced, ultra high quality. And the question is, what's going on here? Is this a bandwagon, media driven bandwagon, that elite universities who aren't really that bothered about recruitment because they tend to be oversubscribed are using as another way of extending their brand? Or is there something deeper happening in terms of learning and teaching and use of technology?
My instinct is, sorry, I just thumped my microphone there. Don't often do that. I was so excited about what you said. Lost control. how sad am I? I think the first instinct there is something massive is happening, no question. This opening out of learning, it's an inevitable thing. You know, from the moment technology allows the internet and you get enthusiasts sharing their learning on the internet free, you know, as you get on YouTube and places like that, this was inevitable. It was going to happen. People are going to start giving learning away. But then you've got the second thing. So what happens to the economics of this? And I think you just touched on something interesting there that I hadn't thought about. You've got an oversubscribed university. People want to go for the gold standard. I attended, I got my equine nutrition degree, although the curriculum would have choked a horse sort of thing, you know. But but maybe there's a whole market there for a... Sorry.
That's terrible.
I know. Sorry. But there's maybe a whole, you know, given that the universities are putting this online, they're not making any money off the people that didn't get in. So supposing you then have a B layer, once you've hooked people, you start having a smaller charge, you know, and the charge isn't for the free online learning. It's the authentication service, you know, who you are and to, you know, to allow you to do some secure exams, that kind of thing. You know, you can see how this could become a kind of a B learning economy. But I just think your questions are fantastic there. You know, what's this about? What's happening? It's so interesting and so exciting, and just part of the acceleration of change in education. Wasn't it Ray Kurzweil said we're heading towards a singularity?
Right.
You know, when everything's just going to come together and technology is just going to explode and take over everything. I think this is just an inevitable part of it.
Yeah. But if you look at what's happening kind of beyond that, the technology in MOOCs is certainly not new. It's nothing much beyond what you get on YouTube, TED Talks, Khan Academy, a few other kind of online offerings. And what strikes me is that interesting is if you're in a university or a school and you're studying one of the areas that's available as a MOOC, you potentially could have Nobel Prize winning academic. So your role suddenly is no longer the content expert. The content expert is freely available online from Stanford, MIT, Harvard, Oxford, Cambridge,
oh yeah,
Edinburgh, St. Andrews, wherever there is high value academic expertise, that's going to be there.
Yeah.
So you're at another university, a further education college and a school. Why does the role of the teacher or the lecturer change? And I think the role as content expert becomes diminished, because the content expert is on, you can get it on YouTube. You can go into Salman Khan's Khan Academy.
Yeah. So, and we need to talk about that one night as well. I love that. Yeah. So interesting. Yeah.
So the role changes to my mind to be much more around contextualizing the content, curating the content,
yep,
mentoring the learner. So you recapture, I think, some of the earlier models of education.
Exactly.
So the content in the past was in a book. You read the book, that's where you got the content. Your time with a tutor or a teacher was spent explaining and contextualizing and linking and discussing and mentoring the learner and suggesting what to study next. I think technology, in a funny way, might be taking us back to an earlier age, a different kind of engagement between the learner and the teacher, which is much more discursive. It's more Socratic in nature rather than transmission based.
Yeah, that's a thought. Yeah, I hadn't seen that. Wow, there's so much in that, isn't there? My girlfriend Julie and I both had a go at one of the units from Udacity, which was, I think, a spin-off, wasn't it, from, was it Stanford? Yeah.
Stanford. Sebastian Thrawn did a course.
That's it,
Introduction to AI, had 180,000 students. I was one of them. Only 5% completed the course, and I wasn't one of those.
Yeah, well, neither were we. We both gave in towards the end. It was quite demanding. But given that I only had a go at it, you know, for the taster, we were looking at, it was his sidekick, I can't recall his name. But, these are big names. You know, Sebastian Thrum is one of the guys who's one of the gurus behind the Google Autonomous Car Project. You know, which is hugely newsworthy and hugely technically important. But his sidekick was doing one on writing a search engine using Python.
Yeah.
So that's the course we were doing. And, you know, certainly what I got from it is, I now understand how you make a search engine now, not in any deep level, but I get how, you know, how scripting languages, you know, can be used for that. Had a taster of a scripting language, and Python certainly looks fabulously powerful and, you know, flexible. Mm-hmm. And a real taste of the community that grew up around that. You know, I think the numbers were huge there as well. I don't remember what it was, but it was in the many thousands, you know, probably, you know, more like the 100,000 than the one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people were online on their forums, as you say, using technologies that are already there, forums, bit of video teaching, some automatic, pretty primitive testing that gave you quick feedback, you know, that, you know, told you whether you got the tutorials right or not. But it was the help areas when people were sharing, you know, in those colossal numbers, you know, how they'd solve the problems and alternative views, even sometimes putting links up to other learning. Just phenomenal. What's happening there, Laurie? We cannot even begin to grasp, I think. You know, what a challenge. And as you say, it's a positive challenge in that teachers are now going to become these, you know, facilitative teachers, you know, Socratic. I like that idea again. But also, you know, as I keep quoting this in Inside Learning, as the head of one of the bodies that represents English girls' private schooling said, and the private schooling is irrelevant here, she said, what's it going to mean when these courses become freely and readily available for our A-levels? What do we need them for? Because actually our A-levels and Highers in Scotland and all that, you know, they really are just part of a sieving system to prepare people for our university access.
Excellent.
Well, there you go. You've got your access. It's what Brian Boyd has asked for as a provocative and creative challenge for years, you know. Mm-hmm. Why not just let everyone that wants to go to university go to university? Well, there we go. We've got it now.
Oh, fantastic. So I think as we go beyond episode 7, I think a proper exploration and investigation of the current practice and future implications of MOOCs would be something worthy of a podcast in the future.
Let's do that. So let's try and bring this to a close with what we said we would do at the start then. Pick one tiny aspect of the new report. For those who don't know, I mean, listeners that will be beyond Scotland. In Scotland, we had a body brought together by the Cabinet Secretary for Education at government level, who asked a group of very unusual people, you know, not the usual suspects, but lots of very, very varied and interesting thinkers and authoritative people on the subject of ICT to, you know, come together and make recommendations about the future direction of, well, first of all, the national intranet GLO. But actually, it was a much wider remit, wasn't it? Really, it was about setting, you know, sort of culture and direction and a bit of visioning for, you know, what schools needed for IT. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, an interesting bunch of people. I think what they did was they produced a report which strikes me as being about 3 years out of date. I think they spent most of their time catching up with what was actually going on, without really shining much light on current practice. And the report's actually pretty poor. To read, there's some good things in it, some really good ideas, but there's nothing in there that I've not heard before. There's certainly nothing in there that's new or very, very exciting. But there's some good stuff. I think that for me, if you picked out some of the recommendations, I think they're certainly worth exploring further.
Oh, you're in a harsh mood tonight, Laurie. Hey, you're in harsh form after excoriating the physics, sorry, the computing curriculum.
That was me trying to be fair-minded. I think you'll find...
No, you did others, say there's other, good things in there.
there's others who would be much more critical of the whole process and certainly the product. It's almost... like a work in progress, I suppose. So if they presented it as a work in progress for further discussion, then good. If they presented it as something that's an authoritative statement on technology and education, then I think it falls well short of the standard I would expect from a body set up by the government.
Okay, well, I would take that view, but I would also put an alternative one, and I don't really want us to get drawn into discussing the kind of pros and cons of the statement because we don't really have the time. But there is an alternative view, which is that, you know, the much of the content of it is not that radical. You know, it's not cutting edge stuff. Although there are bits of, you know, cutting edge pulled together to make a reasonably bold statement, you could argue. But actually, what its purpose might have been was to recognise that a lot of public bodies, not the least of which is 32 local authorities, are quite conservative by nature and are not moving fast. So, you know, if you take the report less as a piece of learning and teaching advice and more as a political statement that it's time to accelerate the change. Maybe it's got usefulness there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But how you bring about smacked, but how you bring about change. So, you know, bring about change by telling people what to do doesn't tend to be very, very, you need to engage people. engage people in a deep and meaningful conversation.
I agree.
Where the real challenges is. So, for example, the recommendation that you have a national filtering policy, it almost looks like an episode of Yes Minister to me.
Which is topical again, I believe.
You know, so again, that'd make a fantastic theme for an evening.
It would be, so, yeah. And so I'm sure Charlie would be happy to come on, Jay Richards Hill or someone to talk about that from the group.
Yeah, because if you think about a filtering policy, if you use the Internet Watch Foundation and say, well, let's use that. That's a national filtering policy. We don't do anything beyond that.
Yeah.
I think that works. As soon as you go beyond that, then you're dealing with very, very different needs. What you filter for a 8-year-old is very different to what you filter for a 17-year-old. I think.
You see, back to that
progressive.
I agree with that, I agree with that, but I do still think there is a defence for them there, which is that... didn't mean to talk to you.
And where do you configure that? Is that configured once nationally? Is that configured at a local authority level or at a school level? But I think there's a big conversation to be had about it.
You're right. But then it will be because, it's not a fait accompli. There's an implementation group now which will take input, presumably, and start to, look at the on the ground. But anyway, the one tiny bit I was just looking for as a quick final view on, they mentioned in it that they thought it was time, and again, this isn't radical, it's not their idea, it's been called for elsewhere. They were making a call for the bring your own device movement to be accelerated, that youngsters are now in a culture when they have, devices at home with browsers, they feel as if, I can't remember the actual quotes of the report, but they were basically saying the spirit of it was that we should begin to allow internet access within schools for those devices. What do you think about that part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, nothing new. People have been saying that. Certainly, when I left learning and teaching Scotland 4 years ago, that was the view, that was the model for the future, was very much... bring your own device, shift towards consumer technology away from local authority or government-provided technology. Issues around bring your own device, there's still a major social inclusion issue that we need to look at. So what if you've not got a device? How do you manage that?
Yeah.
What if half the class have got iPads and others have got Android devices or a smartphone? So there's an equity issue.
A huge one, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think that in any way should stop us trying to do something with it. I think it's a challenge. We've got to recognise it and we've got to deal with it. We deal with all kinds of other challenges. For example, there are lots of families who don't have any books at home.
Yeah.
So we don't work on the basis, we can't use books because some people might not have books at home.
It's a lovely analogy,
So we need to use the commons, the good sense that you bring from the non-technological world into the technological world. Huge issues around technical infrastructure. It requires, it means wireless connectivity, ubiquitous wireless connectivity. We have many schools that don't even have good wired connectivity for a limited number of devices. So the jump between where we are now and having really high quality wireless connectivity, last school I taught had 1,200 pupils.
Mm-hmm.
So 1,200 devices potentially all accessing the wireless network at the same time. We're not in a position to do that yet, I don't think. But we need to address that and fix that quickly.
Yeah.
I think it's a disgrace that we haven't got good wired connectivity schools already. That's a challenge. There are classroom management issues. So how and when students can use these and what's appropriate use and what's inappropriate use.
Timetabling issues that we talked about earlier. These could become a huge part of self-study. But do you then need to timetable self-study periods, perhaps, for your older learners?
That's right. And I think, finally, there are pedagogical or teaching issues that need to be considered. So teachers need to be prepared. They need the CPD to be able to take full advantage of what I think is potentially a fantastic opportunity to enhance learning. So I'm a great believer and fan of bring your own device. It's already happening. It's happening in higher education. It's happening in the corporate world. Schools should certainly be adopting that approach. But they need to adopt it in a way which understands the complexity. It's one thing to say it's a good idea to bring your own device, but if you haven't attacked social inclusion, haven't got the technical infrastructure, you haven't thought your way through the classroom management issues, and you haven't worked with teachers to enhance their skills to be able to take full advantage of it, then it's likely to be a bit of a shambles.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's as good a note as any for us to stop on, right on the 1 hour mark. So it's been great talking to you again tonight, Laurie. I know that we've had you on the podcast, and you helped us out as a regular friend in our 100th episode on Inside Learning. So, you know, we know you to be a great friend and great to speak to, but I hope this is going to get more of it happening. This is good. Yeah. Laurie, where are people able to track you a little bit more? Will they be able to find out about your work?
Okay, well, I tweet at Laurie O-D, L-A-U-R-I-E-O-D. I've got a blog which is a bit neglected. I'm going to write something on MOOCs this week.
Good idea.
You'll find that.
There's your incentive, yeah.
Just laurieodonnell.co.uk, we'll find that. Find me on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. Where else? That's probably the main places. But I tweet more than much else. But I'm definitely need to get back to blogging again.
It sounds like you're one of these guys, Laurie, that could make use of this trend just now in tech circles for people just having a landing page. Just laurieodonnell.com, and send everyone out to your LinkedIn and your Twitter and whatnot from there.
Yeah, that's a good approach. So I'm in the process of redesigning my blog / website. And that sounds just what I need to do, Matthew.
Excellent.
I like that.
So all the Laurie stalkers, we'll send you to one page soon, but for the moment we'll put a few links up on the Inside Learning Technology website. So we don't have a guest lined up or in for next week. We haven't even absolutely promised ourselves a programme next week, but Laurie and I are going to talk as we finish here, and I think we're going to try and do it. That's going to be good.
Yeah, I think, well, next Wednesday at this time looks good in my diary at the moment, so if it suits you, Matthew.
It may well be that it clashes with me doing Inside Learning, so we'll have to have a talk about that. But we actually have a couple of people already lined up to say that they would be guests. So maybe next week, you know, it might be yourself putting out with someone else.
Perfect.
And I would join you again, you know, in a few weeks' time. You know, that would be the kind of model that I think I could make work, juggling between the two casts. Unless, of course, my employers want to give me a day off a week to just work on the podcast. I'm sure my boss will be listening and say, that's a great idea.
I look out the window and see if there's any pigs flying.
They are very supportive, so you never know, but that's probably hoping for a bit too much. Okay then, Laurie, thank you ever so much, and I'll see you soon.
Pleasure as ever, Matthew. Thank you.
Night-night.